Welcome to the Droma Preventative Health Podcast, hosted by the Jewish Orthodox Women's Medical Association. We provide you with up-to-date information on health topics geared towards the Orthodox Jewish community. This podcast content is provided for informational purposes only and is not intended as medical advice or as a substitute for the medical advice of a physician.
Hi, I'm Adassa Stein. I'm a fourth-year medical student at SUNY Downstate. I serve on the JOMA Teen Health Committee and I'm an interviewer for the JOMA Specialty Spotlight Podcast. The Specialty Spotlight Podcasts are geared towards pre-med and medical students interested in learning about different medical specialties. Today, I will be interviewing Dr. Rivka Stone. Rivka Stone, MD, PhD, is a board-certified dermatologist and assistant professor of dermatology and cutaneous surgery at the University of Miami Miller School of Medicine. Dr. Stone completed a combined MD-PhD program at Rutgers New Jersey Medical School, where she was supported by an NIH F30 fellowship for her graduate research. Following an intern year in pediatrics, she completed a physician scientist research residency in dermatology at the University of Miami, where her postdoctoral work focused on chronic wound healing. As a physician scientist, Dr. Stone practices general clinical and procedural dermatology and directs a laboratory studying translational genomics of inflammatory and fibrosing skin disorders. Her research is funded by the NIH, NIDDK, the Dermatology Foundation, and the Wound Healing Foundation. She has over 30 peer-reviewed publications and has received several Young Investigator Awards for her work. In addition to her clinical and research work, Dr. Stone enjoys mentoring high school and college students, in particular, those interested in the physician-scientist pathway, as well as students from backgrounds underrepresented in medicine. She is a member of the University of Miami's Medical Scientist Training Program Committee and co-directs the Dermatology Research Residency Program. Dr. Stone serves as Chief Medical Officer for Elite Medical Prep, a tutoring company committed to maximizing student and institutional performance on high-stakes exams through customized coaching. She lives with her husband and five children in Miami Beach. Hi, Dr. Stone.
Hi, thank you so much for that lovely introduction and thank you for having me.
Thank you. So our first question, why did you choose a career in medicine and what characteristics make one a good fit for a career in medicine?
So that's a good question to start off on because it's not one that I have a great answer to. I can tell you that I always knew that career medicine was what I wanted as far back as I remember as a kid. When everybody else wanted to be firemen or whatnot, I was always saying, I'm going to be a doctor. And it doesn't really actually make sense in retrospect because I am the first one in my family to practice medicine. But for me, it just made sense. I really enjoyed science. I enjoyed math. I'm really a problem solver by nature. So when it came to just like applying knowledge to help people, it just for me, it just made sense. And it was just a natural progression towards doing what I had already assumed that I was going to do all along. But regarding your second question about characteristics that make one a good fit for a career in medicine, that's one that I would probably answer by looking backwards. And I might not have had the answer at the age of 4 or 5. But some of the things that come to mind for me, first of all, are commitment, a commitment to the path, a commitment to taking on everything that it entails, the training and beyond. Another word that I hear a lot on applications, but really does have a lot of significance is the word resilience. So for me, that trait is really, really important when you're talking about a career in medicine, being able to bounce back from challenges. I think that we all have challenges in life and being able to face them and to process them and to deal with them in a way that ends up helping you grow and become even greater is a very important characteristic going in and going forward. And then other characteristics that come into mind for me are things like compassion, and patience for the patients, because you find in medicine that whereas you have everybody has natural biases, natural inclinations, natural thoughts, about different people that they encounter. When you interact with patients, you really have to try as much as possible to intentionally leave those behind and to treat the person in front of you, even if you may not agree with what they're saying or doing, and kind of meet them where they're at. Because basically you're interacting with them at a time where they have a need or where they're experiencing a particular challenge. And then along those lines, the last one that I had that comes to mind for me is tolerance, similar to what I had just said, to really being able to interact with people in a way that maximizes the end result of making them happier, healthier, and more able to function in their lives.
I think that was a great answer. Speaking about resilience, at the symposium, actually, medical school panel on Sunday, one of the questions that was posed to the newly minted residents was, how do you address, I guess, like, quote unquote, failures or red flags in the application? So like a low step score or a clerkship that had to be repeated. And I think the message that like all the residents basically responded was that you need to show growth. So everybody mm-hmm. is going to experience some sort of failure, but failure is actually learning. So if you were able to show that you came back strong on step two, or mm-hmm. When you did the clerkship, you know, over, then you were that amazing medical student, that's what they're kind of looking for. So I think like the resiliency really captures
yeah.
that.
Yeah, I would agree with you. And I would say that for me, as a reviewer of applications, the one thing that stands out is when somebody has a red flag and they choose not to address it. And for me, that's a real shame. Because first of all, for the most part, between all the different components of the applications, you're not going to be able to hide it. So even if you don't kind of explicitly call it out on the parts that you're filling out, there are letters of recommendation that you don't see. There's different elements that kind of come to the, you know, come across. And sometimes when you don't address the red flags, or when you kind of try to excuse them away rather than addressing them in a mature way, I think that it's a really it ends up being a true red flag on your application, one that you're not going to be able to overcome, versus using it as an opportunity, as you say, for demonstrating growth and demonstrating what it means for you and for your future as you move forward. I think to me that is really a critical piece that I'm looking for. Nobody expects perfect people on paper. In fact, perfect people make other people nervous. What we want to see is that we're human and that we're growing. And I think you're just about right there.
That's nice to hear. So our next question, can you walk us through a typical day for you as a dermatologist and tell us why you decided to go into the field of dermatology?
Okay, so I'm going to answer the second part of the question first. So for me, I guess I'm a little different than other derm applicants that I meet now on a regular basis, in that I really did not know that I wanted to be a dermatologist until fairly late, until probably the end of my third year, which is a little unusual. I had gone through my third year rotations, and with each rotation, I was finding that I would do the rotation. I'd be like, okay, this is interesting. I like this part about it, but I don't like that part. So for instance, I liked interacting with patients and really thinking through their problems on internal medicine, but I didn't particularly enjoy like the rounding part of things. For surgery, I liked doing procedures, but I really hated the OR. And I reached the end of third year and I'm like, oh my gosh, I'm like nixing everything. What am I going to do? Like I'm stuck. And then I started, you know, looking into specialties that maybe you don't get as much exposure to. And then I kind of happened upon dermatology, which really in my medical school and many medical schools, very little attention is given to it. And it was really there that I kind of found the sweet spot, because dermatology has a little bit of everything, and you can really kind of choose to emphasize the parts that speak to you in your practice. So for me, I'm very much a physician scientist, and I'll talk a little bit more about that when I talk about my general day, but my aim is really to translate bench to bedside. So research that's done in the lab, translated over to treating patients, and translating over the patient experience back to guide and inform the research. So for me, I really wanted a specialty where that sort of concept was very much supported. And I found that very much in dermatology. There's a lot of programs that exist specifically to train physician scientists. There's a lot of emphasis on pathobiology, on understanding the mechanisms behind conditions and diseases. And there's a lot of diseases in derm, which is wonderful. Lots to study. And I also found that, so I enjoyed the fact that dermatology has a mission to support that sort of thinking. And I found that it was kind of fascinating to me how, you know, even though we're only looking at the skin really tells a very extensive story about what's going on underneath, and the ability to kind of walk into a room to see something and to make sense of it and to really impact somebody's experience or somebody's life really was speaking to me at that point. And I also found that dermatologists as a group, they really like to have fun. They're a fun group of people. They're a smart group of people. They're people that I enjoyed interacting with, colleagues, friends, even in that early point in time when I was doing a few weeks of electives. It was just so fun. And it seemed like to be like the biggest secret that was hidden from everybody up until that point. Like you can actually, for me, I can do procedures. I don't have to be in the OR. Like I mentioned, I can choose to see patients X number of days a week, X number of hours a week, and still be able to give them good care while maintaining my laboratory setup. It just seemed just very feasible and one way to a specialty that really integrated all of my different loves and passions. So that was my long answer to your second part of the question, but going back to what a typical day looks like for me. So I'm an academic dermatologist, which means that I practice in the academic setting. As you mentioned, I'm a faculty member in a university and medical school. So my time is divided, what we call with an 80-20 split, or really in my case, it's 70-30, meaning that I spend 70% of my time doing research activities and 30% of my time during clinical activities. And for me, how that breaks down is that I spend about 2 days a week or two half days a week in clinic. The rest of the time I'm doing research, either I'm in the lab or I'm supervising. I work quite a bit from home. And then also another interesting thing that I do clinically is that I answer consults for cruise ship lines, Royal Caribbean for Carnival as a telehealth option. So for me, it's, in any given day, I'm either in the lab, talking to my technician, to my students, seeing patients, running from one place to the other, or even just sitting at home, writing grants or writing papers. And for me, at least, I mean, some people might go a little bit nuts from all the different components that it sounds like a lot, and it is a lot, I guess, but for me, it's what keeps things interesting. So that for me, I guess my answer is that a typical day is not so typical. It kind of varies based on the mix of what's going on at a given point in time. If it's grant time, everything else is dropped until the grant is done. If it's, a time when clinics are ramping up, there's more emphasis there, but it definitely keeps things interesting and moving.
Yeah, definitely. It sounds really fun, actually. I kind of find the point about dermatology combining the interesting diagnosis with the procedural kind of like interesting, because I was told that when you get to your third year, you should decide, are you the surgical person or are you the like diagnostic more medicine type person? Mm-hmm. So dermatology kind of combines the best of both worlds, I guess, for the people who kind of like a little bit of both.
Yeah, I think that you're right. You're right on that. I enjoy the fact that I can perform smaller surgeries, but surgeries on my patients while they're awake, and I can talk to them as I'm doing it and have fun with them and enjoy getting to know them as people and be able to exercise that kind of skill set. But I don't even know how strongly I can say this. No offense to the surgeons, but I hated the experience of being in the OR. There was something about it that really did not speak to me. And for me to be able to do the procedures without that, all of that extra stuff was so wonderful. And then also, as I said, the ability to change the combination. If you really love surgery, you can be a Mohs surgeon and spend as much as 90% or even sometimes 100% of your time just doing surgery and not practicing general derm. For me, the theme is that I like to keep all my options open. So I do a little bit of everything, which is great.
Yeah. Flexibility is definitely a positive. So our next question, what does a MD-PhD program entail?
So I think this will vary somewhat by institution, and I can't speak for all of the schools, but I think that as a general kind of thematic approach is that You're going to fill out the standard application, the AMCAS, and then usually there's a place where you can indicate your particular interest in applying for the MD-PhD program. Now, MD-PhD programs differ slightly sometimes in terms of how they're receiving their funding. So some of them are funded through an NIH grant, and those are often referred to as MSTP programs, medical science training programs. Others are just funded by the institutions themselves. Depending on, and that doesn't really change necessarily like the actual experience of the students, is just kind of sometimes more of a logistical thing, and you know, there can sometimes be extra requirements tacked on in terms of considerations that the MSTP funded programs have. But you're going to fill out the AMCAS application, you're going to fill out, indicate your interest, and then there's quite a lot of secondary application questions relating to that. So the expectation from somebody who's trying to apply or to enter an MD-PhD program is that they kind of have a sense of what they like about research, why they like it, what they could see themselves doing. Nobody's expecting you to sign on the dotted line exactly what you're going to do, but to be able to review the websites of the medical schools and to identify a few faculty members or areas of research interests that are strong in that particular institution that speak to the applicant, and to kind of articulate that. And then also to be able to see a little bit further into the future. again, nobody really expects that you'll absolutely know where you're going to be, but the ability to understand what the career entails. So you're going to have that kind of articulated in those secondary essays and the secondary aspects of the application. And again, there's going to be a lot of variation between institutions depending on their priorities and their particular mission and things like that. But once you get to the, if assuming that you're fortunate enough to be selected for an interview, because these programs do tend to be rather competitive, then often you'll meet for not only with the standard medical school interviewers, so just like any other applicant to the school, you go through that process, but you also have a secondary set of interviews with the MSTP specific faculty. Sometimes the schools will try to match your stated research interest with a faculty member or somebody in the university that has a similar interest or has similar focus of their research, so that the talk is a little bit more productive. Or sometimes there's not necessarily a match. It's just somebody who's affiliated with the MSTP or the MD-PhD program. And then again, it's kind of a similar process where you're expected not only to talk about why you want to be a doctor, but why you want to be a physician scientist. And it's important to make sure that you're addressing that explicitly, because if that element is missing, it is obvious to the reviewers for the MD-PhD part of the program. And that's pretty much it. It sounds like, you know, I'm not trying to minimize it in any way. It's quite an undertaking. But assuming that it's truly something that you want to do, that you've thought about, that you are committed to doing, then a lot of this will just flow kind of naturally, hopefully. Now, an important thing that many programs are looking for also is that you know what you're getting into. So to whatever extent that's possible. So you have, for one thing, you have mentors that are physician scientists or kind of live in the world that you kind of see yourself being in down the line. So it's important to identify somebody like that if you can, if it's possible. And even just for yourself to know, I mean, is this maybe your breakdown or your particular combination of activities won't be identical to that person, but just getting to know somebody who kind of has the research brain and the clinical brain on in one brain at one time, and to understand how that plays out in terms of what a career would look like, and to articulate that yet again on the application. And then at that point, for the most part, the MD-PhD program follows the way that medical schools work. Many of them have rolling admissions. I know University of Miami does, certainly. But from that point onward, it's only upward from there once you get an acceptance.
Thank you. That was a very thorough review. I hear like from people who actually are in MD-PhD programs in my school that, I mean, like, you have to love research and the process of it. Because that's, from my understanding, it is a commitment of time.
Yes. Yes, it certainly is a commitment of time. And the thing I think that I did not completely fully appreciate as I was going along the process is that time and time again, you're going to be asked to choose your career path over and over. It's not just a one-time split-second decision, okay, I'll do an MD-PhD program. No, after you finish the program, okay, am I going to do a residency that emphasizes research? after I finish my residency, am I going to look for a faculty position, or am I going to choose to go into private practice? Am I going to make research an important part of my career, or am I going to not emphasize it as much? And there's no right or wrong answer to it. It's just that it's not just a one-time decision. It's a continual process. And even year to year, month to month, sometimes it can feel that way where you're like, okay, is it worth it? Yes, it's worth it. Yeah, this is why I'm doing it. Okay, let's do it then. So not a one-time static sort of thing.
I think that's encouraging and exciting that you are always like making those choices. So our next question, talking about research, can you talk about your research in translational genomics of inflammatory and fibrosing skin disorders?
Sure. So one of the things that really attracted me to dermatology from the research side of things is the accessibility of skin to study. Unlike researchers who study the heart or the brain, it's kind of hard to biopsy heart or brain on a regular basis. Not impossible, but difficult versus skin. I mean, in dermatology practice, we're biopsying all the time. So one of the things that I wish I could say that it was intentional, but it wasn't so much. One of the things that I happened to have gotten training in over the course of my PhD was how to do analysis of genomic data sets. So really large data sets that kind of describe differences in gene expression changes across like the entire genome and how to make sense of that data. And it was a really important skill that I was lucky to learn because at that point in time, there was a lot of people were generating data, but a lot of people didn't know what to do with their data. So I really had an opportunity to learn how to make sense of big data sets in a way that could translate to actually moving research forward. So for instance, looking at a set of genes and figuring out, okay, which pathways are most likely to be involved in this particular process and how might we target those pathways with medications or with different models to study it and to approach it and to manipulate it. And then eventually with the hope or the aim to design novel treatments for patients. So going back to the skin then, if you can biopsy the skin, then you can do genomic profiling of the skin. We call it skinomics, right? Which is kind of cute, but definitely captures all the different proteomics, genomics, all the different omics technologies that you can do on skin biopsies from different diseases. You can monitor response to treatment by biopsying sequentially before and after treatment. You can do things like compare subsets of patients within a condition. For instance, if there's plaque psoriasis, there's pustular psoriasis, there's different kinds of subtypes within a particular disease that you can study at that level. And then just being able to apply that kind of toolkit to make sense of particular diseases is really wonderful. So for me, using that skill set, I came into my postdoc time and I happened to be in a program in a setting in my department that's very strong in wound healing. So it was natural for me to do my postdoctoral research. And as it happened, they had some data sets around from a clinical trial that nobody had really made any sense of. So I was able to kind of dive right in, and that was a very good opportunity there. And then from there, I started to realize I originally started doing my research in ulcers and wounds, chronic wounds, venous leg ulcers, diabetic foot ulcers, making sense of what sort of processes are dysfunctional in them and how might we target them. And then I realized that I was developing an interest in what happens to wounds that are not healing in the sense of them becoming scars. So when you have a lot of inflammation that just continues and continues and continues, that's what kind of provokes the scarring process. And that's sort of where I'm at right now, where I'm kind of pivoting a little bit in my own lab to study fibrosing disorders, to study scarring disorders. Currently, the ongoing projects we have are, we have one big one in radiation-induced skin fibrosis, where patients who may be getting radiation for various different reasons, either as part of a cancer treatment protocol or even sometimes in the context of diagnostics in an emergency setting, they're getting fluoroscopy or different things. So they get exposed to higher doses of radiation. The radiation must pass through the skin in order to reach its target. And as a result, some people do go ahead and months to sometimes even years later, they develop a very severe phenotype of scarring. So That's something that we're studying in my lab. And then even just on the clinical side, I have the opportunity to work with patients who have keloids, which is a different kind of scar, to kind of try and make sense of some data sets that are available on that. And then also to try out some of the procedural approaches in the clinical setting and to see how why the procedures that we may use or the treatments that we may use in the clinic, why they're working, how they're working, and things like that. So that is what keeps it fun.
Yeah, it's super exciting. I think that research is amazing because you are providing hope for the patients that are like literally waiting for your answers. Mm-hmm. So you can really, you know, change their life. So like, you know, like I think like the like something comforting for a patient is when you have an answer for them that like no one has been able to answer before. So
yes.
It creates a certain peace of mind. And then I guess hopefully we can actually target those pathways, I guess, whether it's a specific, you know, genomic abnormality that's found with some targeted therapy. But I think even like having the answer is a little bit comforting of like what is going on.
Yeah. Yes, I agree with you. And I think that again, you're right on the mark there as well. I think that patients are looking for answers. And I think you have to kind of read the room when it comes to patients. Some patients come and they just want a treatment. They don't want to know anything like, tell me what to do and make it better. That's it. But some patients really are, especially the ones that are kind of facing more challenging chronic conditions in their skin. They do want to understand, like, why do you think this worked? Why do you think this didn't work? Why would you expect this treatment that, you know, I've already gone through 5 or 6 or 7 treatments that are considered first line, second line, third line. Why are you giving me the fourth line treatment? Why would this time be different? And the ability to articulate that and translate it into a way that the patients understand, I think they really do have an appreciation for that. And you can be very honest and you can say, look, and this is one of the things I also love about dermatology, that we're really good at repurposing medication. So most of what we do, much of what we do is off-label because there haven't necessarily been randomized controlled trials to demonstrate that something works or why it works. But we just know in clinical practice that it seems to work. So we're constantly playing around and saying, hey, you know, this worked for this condition. And it seems like, you know, histologically, there's similarities to that condition. So let's try this treatment for that condition. And you can kind of really do that in the moment in dermatology, which is a lot of fun. But again, the ability to articulate to patients why you think it'll work and how it might work if it does and when it does, and you hope that it does, and to kind of be on their team. And again, what I was saying before about meeting them where they're at, I think that's a very, very powerful thing that I feel privileged to be able to offer and to articulate to my patients.
Yeah. So you can be a teacher, I guess, to
yes.
in the academic setting, but also for patients.
Absolutely no. As an in academics, you're teaching everybody all the time. I think you're always, it's not even just in academics, you're always teaching people, regardless of the context that you're working in. I think that's a theme that is throughout. Mm-hmm. Yes.
So our next question, what inspired your role as Chief Medical Officer of Elite Medical Prep?
So this one is an interesting one. When I was a fourth year medical student and I had a little bit of what I'm going to call downtime in quotes, I decided that I wanted to make a little bit extra money. And I had heard about a tutoring company. It was not Elite Medical Prep as it happens at the time, because we're going back a number of years. I won't say how many. But I was like, hey, you know, it'd be fun. I'd already done some tutoring for fellow medical students at the request of some of the student affairs office in my school at Rutgers. And one of my medical students said, hey, you know, there's this company that I work for. They tutor and you can make good money. It's easy to do. It's fun. It's great. And I'm like, hey, yeah, I think I'll give it a try. So I interviewed for the company. At the time, it was fairly small. This originally company was called Med School Tutors. And I started there as a tutor. And then over the years, I just kind of continued with the company without even meaning to. So I started taking on more of a leadership role. So I started to mentor new tutors who were coming in. I was working on some content projects and, designing different flashcard systems and QBank, designs, different things that I was involved in. And it was so much fun because it was kind of like something different from what I was doing along the way. And there would be points in time, like when I was an intern, where I didn't have much time to tutor. So I had to kind of, step back from the actual one-on-one tutoring, but then I would come back to it when times were a little bit less busy. And it just kind of followed me through. And then there were a few just critical points in time where I was offered larger leadership roles in the company. And that kind of culminated into serving as a chief medical officer of med school tutors. Now that company was subsequently sold. And then I ended up switching over to Elite Medical Prep. And one of the things that I really love so much about this work, in addition to it being so different in a way from what I'm doing in my day job, is that, I think that it's all about like the bigger picture. So when you see one patient, you have the ability to impact the life of that one patient, or the experience, I should say. The experience of that one patient. When you do research, you're kind of impacting, larger groups of patients, or more broadly, more globally, the groups of patients that suffer from that shared condition that you're trying to research. And then when you come to this sort of, the tutoring context, or the leadership of the tutoring context, you're influencing the student experience. And by influencing their educational trajectory, you then influence all the patients that they see. So it's really a very powerful thing. And it's something that I'm very passionate about. And one of the things that I do in the context of my role currently is that I get to interface with many institutions, with many medical schools, and learn about how they do things and try and troubleshoot and brainstorm ideas and courses and ways to target things that they have, that they've identified as pain points. So I think that I'm going to keep using the word fun. It's a fun but very meaningful way for me to contribute to the medical education side of things. It's quite distinct from what I'm doing in the faculty position.
As a medical student, I can definitely say I appreciate passionate attendings who are good teachers. I think that I was actually a teacher for a year as well. And I think it's kind Great. Of like nice what you're like the point that you make, that I guess, every student hopefully will go on and, influence the future generations as well.
Yes.
So our next question, if you could go back in time, given the experience and perspective you have now, is there anything you'd want to have done differently?
Yeah, I think that I would tell my prior self to stop trying to plan so much. I think that as a whole, many of us, and I include myself with everybody else in the hopes of normalizing my experience, hopefully that's valid. But many of us are very much type A type of people, very much the planner is a sort of like, well, if I do this and I do this and I check this box and I have this experience and this is going to happen and that's going to happen and then I'll get to there, which is where my goal is. So let me just do it in sequence. So I would tell myself, stop trying to plan, and also stop trying to place so much emphasis on a single decision. When you're applying to medical school, it's like that point of where am I going to go feels like, which school am I going to end up in for 4 years? What it's going to mean to my life and all that. It feels like the biggest decision and the critical shifting point of your life at that moment. And I would say like, chill. It really is not that critical. Your experience is going to vary here or there. But at the end of the day, you come out trained to practice medicine one way or the other. And similarly, getting super hyper-focused during residency application time, I kind of had in my head, what would be the perfect setup? And I was like, it must be this or nothing else. It's not going to work unless it works out this way. And time again, it didn't work out the way I had thought, but it was that much better in a way that I'd never even imagined. So I would say just let things unfold and realize that you as a person, and I'm talking to myself now, like you evolve as you go through the process. Certainly if you're doing an MD PhD, you have many years to evolve. But even if you're doing standard MD, you're the self that you are as an M1 or an MS1 is not the self that you are as an MS3 or 4, or even when you finish residency, when you start residency, when you're in residency, when you finish, like you grow as a person. So stop trying to predict the next 20 years and just enjoy the moment.
I appreciate that advice just because I am like in the residency application cycle now. Mm-hmm. And I think it's true. I just got like, you have to like enjoy the moment. It's also kind of cute what you were saying about you know, the person that you started off as is not necessarily the person as you end with. My medical school did this activity with us the first day of school that we had to write a letter to ourselves. I guess like, you know, like whatever mindset was going through and our concerns or just like a letter to ourselves in the future. I completely forgot about it. And I just got a manila envelope. I was so excited. Like, who's like giving me snail mail? Sure enough, it's myself. I'm mailing myself. But like at the moment, I thought it was like kind of cheesy, but then I opened it up and I'm like, it's so funny. Like I have really changed since then. That's what they said that, you know, would happen. And it's like, it, you know, the experiences that you have and the people you meet really transform you. In that time.
Absolutely. And you go through a lot in that period of time and you continue to. So absolutely.
So our last question, what advice would you like to leave the pre-med and medical students listening to this podcast with?
I think the first part of it, I think I just mentioned, which is just about enjoying the process. I'm not trying to be super hyper fixated and forget to enjoy the process, but I think the other thing I would want to emphasize, and I want to emphasize, is that at the end of the day, regardless of what direction you end up going in after you finish your training, as they say, the world is kind of your oyster. It's really a privilege to be a physician, whether you end up practicing medicine, whether you end up doing some research or more research or less research, whether you end up completely pivoting and taking on a non-clinical career. There's this kind of hidden curriculum of medical training. So even if you don't end up practicing medicine per se, there are so many things that you've learned along the way, keeping cool under pressure, being systematic, thoughtful, organized, focused. So really just taking a moment to recognize your privilege in being able to take in all those lessons and come out ready to face the world in a way that will hopefully also give you, you know, something that you can live off of, and you will. But also in terms of recognizing your privilege as being the conduit to really being able to help people, whether it ends up being your patients or friends and family that are going through medical crises or going through a difficult time, or even yourself as, you know, you navigate your own medical, personal medical situations, appreciating what you've been given, the training you've been given, both explicit and again, hidden, and really being taking a moment to think about how you can utilize your experiences and your abilities, your skill sets and your personality to really make a difference in the world and to impact people's lives.
Thank you. I think that was amazingly put. So when I was reading this letter, one of the big, like, I guess, lessons that I learned throughout medical school is all this other things that you say go into being a good doctor and like a good healthcare provider. It's not just like the books, but, you know, working on being compassionate, working well on a team, being efficient. I think those are, you know, huge parts of being a good doctor as well. So thank you so much.
Of course, my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me. Really appreciate the opportunity.
It was a pleasure speaking with you.
All right.
Thanks for listening to the JOMA Preventative Health Podcast. If you've enjoyed this, please rate and review us on Apple Podcasts and share this with your friends. For more information, check out our Instagram at JOMA_org. Check out our website, www.joma.org, that's JOMA.org, or email us at health@joma.org.